Now, Defense Secretary Robert Gates said today there is evidence of Iran's involvement in Iraq. We'll have more on that in a moment. But first, this morning, senators on the Armed Services Committee sparred over pre-war intelligence on Iraq. Senators heard from the Pentagon's Inspector General about a classified report he wrote, which concludes that pre-war intelligence work done by Douglas Feith and his Office of Special Plans in the Pentagon was inappropriate but not illegal. Committee Chair Democrat Carl Levin called it a devastating condemnation of the administration. But Republican James Inhofe of Oklahoma took issue with Levin.
You can read the same report and come with up with different conclusions. I don't think in any way that his report could be interpreted as a devastating condemnation.
Inhofe pressed Thomas Gimbel, the acting inspector general, to characterize his own report.
Would you say that your report is a devastating condemnation against Secretary Feith?
My report is what I view it is a flat, fact-based report of the events that occurred. I don't have an opinion as to whether it's devastating or not devastating.
Well, joining us now on the line from Washington, Mark Hosenball, investigative reporter for Newsweek magazine. Mark, do you have an opinion of this report?
Well, in fact, my opinion is it's kind of milder than I thought it would be, and it doesn't go anywhere near as far as I thought it would go. So, on the other hand, it makes some interesting points, but it doesn't really tell us, those of us who have followed this issue for some period of time, a great deal that we didn't already know.
Well, tell us what it does tell you that you might have known but others didn't. What intelligence about Iraq and al-Qaeda before the war is in question here?
Well, what it basically talks about is how a very small group of people inside the policy directorate at the Pentagon under Donald Rumsfeld, Paul Wolfowitz, Deputy Secretary of Defense, and Douglas Feith, Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, were assigned shortly after 9/11 to basically review intelligence reports produced by other agencies, initially to find evidence of state sponsorship of terrorism in general, 9/11 in particular, and later this was refined to look for evidence connecting Saddam Hussein to al-Qaeda and 9/11. And what the report alleges is that ultimately this small group of people, or it was actually a small group of changing people, different people at different times, came up with a series of slideshows which they presented at different times to different members of the administration, alleging, taking various bits of intelligence, alleging that Saddam Hussein was connected to al-Qaeda and may have had some connection to 9/11. And what the report says was that basically the bits of intelligence that the Pentagon picked out to make these points were not necessarily validated or accepted by the rest of the intelligence community, and that the Pentagon people, their efforts to produce this intelligence and to present it to people were inappropriate because they were basically destroying the information.
Well, remind us, first of all, Douglas Feith, we know, was part of a group of former officials in the 90s who supported Ahmad Chalabi and other Iraqi exiles. Is it thought that he brought an agenda to his role in the Defense Department?
Well, it doesn't necessarily say that in this report, but certainly that's what people who have looked into this issue believe.
And we understand the report concluded that in all of the cases that you mentioned and others, including the alleged meeting of Mohammed Atta and Iraqi intelligence in Prague, which was discounted, that all of the cases that Feith presented this to his superiors as fact when it was doubted in other intelligence circles.
Well, certainly the Pentagon report alleges this. And in fact, there was one slide which only was presented to a White House briefing, which is attended by, of all people, Steve Hadley, then Deputy National Security Advisor, now National Security Advisor, and a person named Scooter Libby, who I think you may have heard a little bit about recently, then Vice President Cheney's Chief of Staff. This briefing was the only briefing, although there were two other versions of the briefing, which contained this one special slide going into great detail about the alleged meeting before 9/11 in Prague of Mohammed Atta with an alleged Iraqi intelligence agent. It even this slide, which we actually published about a year ago by Newsweek, even alleged that cited some sort of intelligence reporting that Atta and his brother were spotted at Prague Airport. Not only could I not find any senior intelligence people or even lower down intelligence people who had ever seen the original reporting on this, but it turns out Mohammed Atta didn't even have a brother. So somebody was really reaching deeply to find intelligence to make a point here, and maybe arguably some of this intelligence was literally made up.
Well, so another Republican on the committee, Senator Saxby Chambliss of Georgia, questioned the inspector general today. He said, you know, Feith's office didn't produce intelligence. They just produced analysis. We're going to be speaking to Anthony Cordesman, who reminds us, he said, remember, there were hundreds of consultants that were hired by people like Feith to come up with the information they wanted to make their point in presenting this analysis, not intelligence.
Well, I think the hundreds of consultants, by the way, is a bit of a canard. I mean, one of the really interesting things about this is that there were actually only handfuls of consultants. There were very few people involved in this, and yet these few people had arguably an inordinate impact. I don't think there were, I mean, there may have been hundreds of consultants working for the Pentagon. There was literally probably less than literally five people who worked on this whole thing all the way through.
But in other words, they were happy to come up with the analysis that people in the Pentagon wanted. What is Feith saying about the report today?
Well, Feith has been bitterly attacking it and saying it was all authorized what he did and he wasn't really producing intelligence. He was just critiquing intelligence, some of which is true, but, you know.
He seems to also be saying that it is not illegal. It is not illegal what was
done. Well, the Inspector General didn't accuse them of doing anything illegal. It's not clear to me that anything that they did do was illegal. It just arguably, certainly according to the Inspector General anyway, questionable if not inappropriate.
Mark Hosenball, investigative reporter for Newsweek magazine. Mark, thanks.
Okay.
Well, as the Pentagon's Inspector General criticizes pre-war intelligence on Iraq, Bush administration officials are offering up evidence providing a link between Iran and insurgents in Iraq. Secretary of Defense Robert Gates said today that serial numbers and markings on explosives used in Iraq provide pretty good evidence that Iran is providing weapons or technology to militants in Iraq. Iranian officials have, of course, denied this. So joining us on the line now is Anthony Cordesman, military analyst at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Anthony, the Pentagon report that we just talked about says that former Undersecretary of Defense Douglas Feith's office was predisposed to finding a significant relationship between Iraq and al-Qaeda. How will that report on pre-war intelligence in Iraq shade Gates' announcement of evidence linking Iran to Iraqi insurgents?
Well, I think we should very carefully separate the two. In the one case, you had people assembling of facts designed to provoke a war. In the case of what Secretary Gates has said, it follows similar statements by U.S. officers in Iraq. There has been a debate in both the American and British intelligence communities now for several weeks over how to best release what they feel is very conclusive detail. The problem that you have here is that that information has not been released. What you have are broad statements. They come in the context that both the British and American white papers on weapons of mass destruction in Iraq were grossly wrong and manipulated politically. And one of the things I think that U.S. officials have not yet understood is that if they're going to say things, they have to prove their credibility.
Earlier this week, National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley said the administration was withholding a report on evidence then because they wanted to get it right, and Gates added they needed the facts, they needed the serial numbers, and so on. But it's confusing because we also hear former CIA analyst Bruce Rydell tell Newsweek that the kind of evidence the administration would need doesn't seem to exist. What is the kind of evidence that is needed, and do you think it exists?
Well, I believe some evidence exists, but one of the problems here is it is almost inevitable that Iran is going to interfere in some ways in Iraq. All of the major parties in the Shiite coalition in Iraq, except for the Sadr party, were based in Iran. Their militias were armed and trained by Iran. There has been a process of having people from these militias go back into Iran since the fall of Saddam. Iran sees the United States as a serious threat positioned in a neighboring power. And while it has not been dramatically aggressive, it's not going to be passive.
Strategically, do you think that the involvement of Iran, to whatever extent it is, in Iraq is something that the U.S. just has to accept? Because as you said, and we've heard this from the top aide to the prime minister, of course they're there. We share a border and our people are, you know, it's a very porous border. Or do you think that it's something that the war of words should become more?
Until we know that this involves the transfer of technologies, we have to be very, very careful. And the problem is, what we have heard as yet is nothing that puts this in perspective. There's no timeline. There's no indication of the scale of the effort. There's no indication of which groups are receiving what kind of weapons with what intention. And both the British and U.S. governments have to remember just how seriously damaged their credibility is, and they have to surface the evidence. And I believe there is evidence that is convincing of Iranian activity, but what is not clear to anyone outside government is the scale and importance involved, and whether this is simply an irritant or something that requires a U.S. military response.
What do you make of the number of helicopters that have been shot down? Do you think that this is a sign that Iran is giving more, let's say, heat-seeking missiles to Iraq?
Well, there's no evidence whatsoever of that, and no one has made that charge. Most of these attacks seem to have come from the use of automatic weapons, a change in tactics by Sunni insurgents. They don't seem to have come from any kind of special training. And weapons like the SA-7 and certain other man-portable surface-to-air missiles were taken out of the arms depots that Saddam Hussein had after the collapse. So I think nothing is more dangerous than speculating on the basis of the kind of statement that I suspect Secretary Gates very carefully qualified and then trying to parse it out into a much broader pattern of attacks. We have to understand how dangerous it has been over the last few years to speculate about threats which didn't materialize. It's dragged us into a major war. And the last thing on earth we need to do is look at a power as unstable and potentially dangerous as Iran and find ourselves provoking yet another confrontation without clear evidence and without definitive cause.
What kind of evidence would you need to see as proof of Iran arming Iraq?
What I would expect to see is, who are we accusing of making the transfers? Who did they transfer it to? What are the specific examples? What are the types of weapons involved? All of this can be done without revealing sources and methods. And all of it fairly rapidly is something that people on the scene can provide some degree of independent confirmation, because reporters, people who are there, people in the Iraqi government, other sources are going to confirm or deny whether this is credible or not very quickly. What you cannot have are generalized statements that don't really explain, don't provide detail, and rely on authority rather than explanation.
Anthony Cordesman, military analyst at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Well, after a quick break, we're going to stay in Iraq, where two women Marines were killed this week. What happened to the rule that women can't serve in combat? And later, from Iraq war vets to athletes, the new community of brain injured. That's ahead here and now. Two American women serving in Iraq died this week. Marine Corporal Jennifer Parcell of Bel Air, Maryland, died on Wednesday. That same day, 28-year-old Marine Captain Jennifer Harris of Swampscott, Massachusetts, died while piloting a helicopter north of Baghdad that crashed. They're among the more than 70 American women killed so far in Iraq. We're going to spend a few minutes today talking about women in the military with Tammy Duckworth. She lost her legs when her helicopter was shot down in Iraq in November 2004. She came home, ran for Congress as a Democrat in Illinois. She lost, but she's now Director of Veterans Affairs in Illinois and is on the line with us. Tammy, the question is raised again. You know, we thought women were not allowed to serve in combat.
The only job where women are technically allowed in combat was as pilots. It's actually one of the reasons why I requested aviation to become a pilot, because it was the only combat job for women.
But as we've seen, especially in the last few weeks, the combat is in the helicopters.
Actually, the most dangerous job you can have in Iraq probably is truck driver. And women have been serving as drivers going back to World War II.
We remember the convoy that was attacked and several women soldiers attacked then as well.
Absolutely. And you know, driving a convoy in a war like this, where there are no front lines, where the enemy is everywhere, everybody, you know, doctors and nurses were being shelled in Baghdad. So there's no line. So the definition of combat simply has not caught up to the reality of the war as it exists in Iraq today.
But do women in Iraq are they holding weapons and running in, you know, kicking down doors?
Some of the infantry units that go in and kick down doors have to take a female with them, and usually they get a female who's a medic who's attached to them. Even though technically the unit may be an all-male unit, they have to bring a female with them so that they can search the female Iraqi civilians.
So that's another blurring of the line, I would think.
Mm-hmm. So it's really a matter of our definitions of combat are just outdated for modern warfare.
But truly, are there things that, let's say a unit you say has to take a woman with them, and so she is just as much in the line of fire, and she can fire if she's, you know, bursting through a door, and that becomes the front line.
Every one of us is issued an M16 machine, a rifle with bullets.
But would she ever yet lead the unit going through that door?
Well, there are women who are military police commanders who certainly lead their units of military policemen through doors. And those units are the ones that are doing the policing in some of these tough areas in Iraq. And I really, you know, the thing that I really want to stress is that the definition of combat has changed. There are women in leadership positions. We have a female who has won the Silver Star, who led a squad of in response to an ambush, and she led it very successfully, who is a National Guardsman. There's a girl at Walter Reed right now who's a double amputee below the knees, and she was in the turret of her vehicle, and she was the only one out of her unit that survived because she took the toughest job, which was the gunner on the top, and she was actually thrown free. So there are some tough chicks out there. And I do want to say one thing. I get a lot of these questions from even friends and people who are not that familiar with the military, who want to know what it was like for me to be in a combat job as a pilot. And I just say, you know, a woman's life is no more precious than a man's. And I would, if I were a man, I would be pretty insulted. Or if I was the mom of a male soldier, you know, her son's life is no less precious than someone else's daughter's life. We are soldiers. We are comrades. We are there to cover each other's backs and get out of the line of fire when we do come under fire.
Well, you know, there are some, as you know, who disagree with that. Perhaps they haven't served as you have, but, you know, they would say there's something fundamentally wrong and also disturbing. I mean, this is the old, old, old argument that there's something not just wrong about that a woman's life is more precious. They're the people who bear the children, but that also it may disrupt troops, male troops, in a combat situation.
Well, I think that they're just out of touch with the reality of the situation. I was the first female commander of my Black Hawk assault helicopter company, and I've often been the only female in an all-male unit, and it's made absolutely no difference. It's about getting the job done. When the bullets start flying, you care less about whether the person next to you is a man or a woman. All you care about is that she's a good shot.
What are the problems that women might see when they come home? Here you are again, the director of the Veterans Affairs in the state of Illinois. Do you see women have a different adjustment on reentry as men do, or is it all the same?
I think some of the issues with post-traumatic stress disorder are the same. Some of the readjustment things that I saw, and this is just from my personal experience, were just some of the systems in the VA have not caught up to women yet. When I showed up at my VA hospital, my federal VA hospital, for example, and went after my yearly exam to go get my prescription from my form of birth control, they didn't have it. They had Viagra, but the VA system hadn't caught up to the large number of female combat veterans who are coming back into it. They're adjusting very quickly, and that's the federal system. You know, the states are certainly reacting much more quickly than the federal government can.
And finally, the two women that prompted this conversation today, Jennifer Parcell, we're still learning more about her from Maryland, 20 years old. We know a lot about Marine Captain Jennifer Harris. She's from here in Swampscott, Massachusetts, a star in her high school, always wanted to fly, and we've been hearing Marines here, older Marines, say that she was just the cream of the crop, an elite soldier. Did you know her?
I did not know her. The Sisterhood of Female Helicopter Pilots is small, but it's not that small. But her story is kind of, you know, very similar to mine. When I was shot down, I was a captain as well. It's that mid-career time when you're out there doing your job. And I will tell you that there's nothing that we love more than to be in command of that giant machine. And the fact that our country trusts us and has invested its trust and its belief in us to not only be pilots, but also to command and to also lead other soldiers into combat is something that you don't get anywhere else in the world. And, you know, it's why I wanted to serve, because this is a great country.
So her parents are right in saying that she died doing what she wanted to do.
Absolutely. I've often told people, you know, they said, how do you feel about that day? And I said, you know, I made it home, and my life now, it's all gravy. It's a bonus. But if I had died that day, it would have been an okay death, because I died fighting to my last breath to do my job as a soldier. And that's all any of us wants to do.
Tammy Duckworth lost both her legs while serving in Iraq. She's now the head of the Illinois Department of Veterans Affairs. Tammy, thanks for speaking with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, stay with us. More ahead here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from
Now, in the lead-up to the Super Bowl, you may have seen the story of former New England Patriot linebacker Ted Johnson. Johnson, who retired 2 years ago, went public with the news that he suffers brain injury as a result of concussions. Well, Johnson's story came on the heels of reports that the suicide of former Philadelphia Eagle defensive back Andre Waters may have been linked to concussions he sustained during his NFL career. A pathologist said he had the brain tissue of an old man. So what's happening inside your child's helmet? Arlene Korab and Inta Hall want parents to ask that question. They're members of the Brain Injury Association of Massachusetts. Now, their interest in this subject began when their sons were severely brain injured in separate car accidents in 1980. Both were not wearing seatbelts, and both became part of a sudden, huge population saved by new medical technology like EMTs without programs to help them live with a head injury. Well, now these two mothers want to apply the same energy they put towards seatbelts awareness towards sport injuries, and they join us in the studio. Welcome, Arlene Korab, Director of the Brain Injury Association of Massachusetts.
Thank you very much, Rob.
And Inta Hall is also with the group. She's the public policy consultant. Welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
Well, so you both come to your concern about brain injuries the hard way. Do we know why there are so many sports injuries now, Arlene?
I have my own personal theory on when we start out with young children and we start them out in sports. You know, we don't realize how many times they bang their head, and because they're not bleeding, we don't think that they have a problem. But the cumulative effect of all of those bangs, eventually by the time they reach high school and college and the pros, you know, they're well into the sport, and they're not going to admit that they're not feeling well or they're not things aren't functioning the same way.
In the course of taking up this concern, you've been hearing from professional athletes.
Oh, yes. A number of our conferences that we've had in the last so many years, there have been athletes who have retired now as professionals. And they tell you that they've had many, many concussions. And remember, concussion is a brain injury. And one of the football players, I remember saying that he had 13, and he thought that he was really going mad, so to speak, and was losing his mind until he was properly diagnosed. And then he started thinking back and realizing that it was an accumulation of untreated brain injuries. Once it was treated, he was doing much better.
Well, in fact, at one of your annual conferences, you heard the story of William Braun. This is a Pop Warner football player. His father is Robert Braun, and it was also his coach. Other parents might be thinking, this is going to ring a bell. Tell us that story.
Yeah, Willie was playing Pop Warner football. He was injured on the field. He came off the field. It didn't look like he had an obvious problem. Apparently, he sat out for a few minutes. Dad sent him back in where he was hit again. It was weeks later that he started to exhibit signs of something seriously wrong.
Like what?
Well, his memory was slipping. He didn't remember who his parents were. He'd come downstairs for breakfast, and he didn't know whether he was, you know, drinking orange juice or milk or coffee. And he didn't know his dog. He didn't know the name of his dog. And, you know, eventually, obviously, his parents realized this is more than just a little bump on the head, and they started investigating got him to some serious brain injury rehabilitation.
I understand that there's a test that professional football teams and a lot of college teams use to determine if a player who has suffered a hit and a concussion is fit to go back on the field, but this test isn't used in high schools?
Well, they're starting to use it. A number of neuropsychologists who are starting to do this test, they call pre- and post-neuropsych tests, baseline tests on what the player is like normally before they start a sport, and every time they're injured on the field, they take them off immediately, and they do another neuropsych test on them on a computer that sits right on the field. It'll give you enough information to know if the player is fit to go back or not.
What are some other symptoms that parents can look for to make them realize their child's having the effect of a concussion?
Behavior in school, changes of behaviors in school. Sometimes, you know, you go from a child who was an A student and now maybe they're failing their classes, they can't concentrate, they fall asleep at their desk in school. And very often what happens to a lot of these kids is it may not be a sport that they were playing for school. It may be an after-school activity. Nobody really knows that they were injured.
So you should tell your kids, tell me.
Tell me. Yeah. But they don't want to tell their parents because they want to play. You know, they want to be part of it. But it changes their personality completely. They do develop behavior problems. Now if they develop a behavior problem, now that they're labeled as bad kids. And they're not bad kids. They're just kids who need to be taken care of medically. But if you don't see blood, you don't think your kid is hurt.
Well, that takes us back to New England Patriots linebacker Ted Johnson. He didn't want to talk to people about his problem. In fact, he would take too much of his medication and then lock himself in his apartment until he could get a new prescription. We understand that doctors call these people who have milder or maybe not visible symptoms of brain injury the walking wounded. And a lot of insurance companies won't pay for their long-term care.
My son was in rehabilitation 6.5 years, but he was injured in 1980, where the health insurance people paid a lot more. I think right now, if you get 4 or 6 weeks, you're lucky. And it takes quite a few years to get someone back to a functional level.
4 to 6 weeks, as opposed to 6 years, really?
Yep. That's all the insurance companies will pay for.
And what they call, what we call cognitive rehabilitation, which is very, very helpful to people with brain injuries, and that many of them say, well, it's not medically necessary.
Well, now there's a whole new population. We know that this spring you're going to be involved in a project that's going to look at the problem of brain injuries among troops returning from both Iraq and Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. What is the problem there?
Well, most of the troops that are coming back now, we've been told that at least 60% of them come back with brain injuries, and those are due to blast injuries. They don't have to be directly hit. They could be within a half a mile of the blast, and still their head reverberates inside of their helmet.
In fact, we're reading that the brain injury is being described as the signature wound of these wars because of that concussive effect. So what? I know you're going to start here in Massachusetts with a Rehabilitation Commission's statewide program. What are some of the things that you want to do?
Our job is to make it more public that we're here to help the family. You send out a young father. He comes back. He doesn't remember he had the child, or he doesn't remember the children. You know, he has all the effects of a brain injury, but the wife doesn't understand it or can't see it, so she doesn't know what's going on with him.
Do you think that that's true of the medical profession as well? Do you think that a lot of the Iraq soldiers and perhaps other soldiers who've been maybe diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder actually have been suffering head injuries?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And we're hoping that if this model is successful, then we can take it to other veterans of other wars. But, you know, we can't take on the world right now. We don't have that much, money to do this with. So the grant is just for this current war that we're in. We were told that there are over 1,000 people in the Northeast alone that are coming back from Iraq who have suffered brain injuries. And so we're launching a billboard campaign, and we're putting out some literature to let them know that we're available, our organization is available to help them and to support them and to send them to the right type of doctors for treatment.
Arlene Korab, we've also been speaking with Inta Hall. Both of them have sons who suffered brain injuries from car accidents years ago. Now they're working to help people with sports brain injuries or injuries from the Iraq War. They're with the Brain Injury Association of Massachusetts. And by the way, this group is nationwide. So for more, go to our website, here-now.org. Thank you both for giving us some of your time.
Thank you.
Thank you for us.
You're listening to Here and Now.
Little joining us, as he does every week, to talk about the world of sports is Only a Game host Bill Littlefield. And Bill, it's good to see you, but particularly today because you just were listening intently to our conversation about sports-related concussions in young athletes.
Yeah. Yes.
And you're going to be looking at that issue on the professional level this weekend.
Well, Robin, I was honored to be able to speak this week with Christopher Nowinski, who's written a book called Head Games. Chris is a former college football player and professional wrestler. He suffered a terrible concussion as a wrestler and had awful problems after that and really couldn't understand it. He said as far as he knew, it was the only concussion he'd ever had. And then he sat down with Dr. Cantu, and they went back through his history. And, of course, Chris realized that he'd had many, many concussions beginning as a college football player. People don't sometimes understand that you don't have to become unconscious to suffer a concussion.
Right.
And that's part of the reason why players so often return to the game a few minutes after suffering one, and everybody thinks that's just
fine. And you mentioned Dr. Robert Cantu. He's the neurologist who's currently treating the former Patriot linebacker Ted Johnson, who we spoke of.
Correct, as well as numbers of other people who have suffered similar injuries.
Okay, so I know that's provoked a lot of thought, so listen in for that this weekend. We'll keep that conversation going. A couple other quick notes from sports. American cyclist Floyd Landis, he was the controversial winner of last year's Tour de France. He tested positive for an unusually high level of testosterone. He denied wrongdoing, but now he's saying he's not going to defend his title.
Yes, Floyd Landis is avoiding being banned from racing in France by declaring in a preemptory sort of way that he does not wish to race in France. Well, it's only the place where the most famous bicycle race takes place, but, you know, you got to do what you got to do.
Okay, that's story there. Well, let's look up here. In college basketball, North Carolina, the women from Duke remain undefeated by beating the only other previously undefeated team in the nation, the women from UNC. Now, what does that say about the state of women's basketball that both these teams come from schools with also high-ranking men's teams?
Well, I'm not sure to what extent we can draw conclusions that connect the two teams. I think the only thing you can safely say is that, like the men's teams at those particular universities, the women's teams are headed by coaches who are extraordinarily effective at recruiting wonderfully talented basketball players.
And colleges seem to help them along in ways that colleges do.
Yeah, I think, you have to be a little careful, though, connecting the men and the women on this Pat Summit, of course. Of course, the extraordinarily successful Tennessee coach of the women's team there has said of the opportunity to coach the men's team, no thanks, I'm perfectly happy with the women.
Yeah. So, Bill, what else might we look for this weekend?
Well, we're going to have a story about a martial artist, an American, who went to the Shaolin Temple in China and learned a great deal more than he already knew about Kung Fu. You remember Kung Fu from the Fu from the David Carradine days. And we're going to have, of course, Charlie Pierce present, as he always is, to comment on all sorts of sports-related and only vaguely related sports matters.
We will join you for that. Bill Littlefield's Only a Game on the weekend on NPR. Be sure to listen in. Bill, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, we have time now for just a couple of your thoughts, and we want to share them with you. Burke Cox of Philadelphia wrote after our piece on the new Freelancers Union, which offers health benefits for part-time workers. But as Burke writes, only in the state of New York. Right you are, Burke. Our editing error, FU, as it's called, is nationwide, but health benefits for now are only available in New York. And Ed Onesimo wrote after our chef, Kathy Gunst, recommended that you have oysters for Valentine's Day, but have them opened by a professional. Ed writes, Julia Child's method was to hold the oyster in a dish towel and use a simple can opener to pry the shell open at the hinge, the back of the oyster. The experts all seem to pry a knife into the other front end of the shell, but like Kathy Gunst, I find that impossible. Julia's method is ridiculously simple. Boy, was she great. Boy, was she. And boy, did we hear from you after our segment on Barack Obama's background, some African-Americans saying he can't be called black because he doesn't descend from slaves. Well, we're going to devote some time to your thoughts on the subject next week. If you want to hear that segment, you can listen to it or download it by going to hear-now.org and clicking on the archives. And by the way, you can always send us your emails there as well on anything on the program. Well, next up, our very own in-house fashionista. You're listening to Here and Now. now. While most of us can't wait for spring, the fashion world is gearing up for fall. Fashion Week 2007 is wrapping up in New York City after a week of showing off all the styles that'll be on the racks at the end of the summer. For a look at what's ahead, we're joined by Gina Kelly, fashion director at 17 Magazine. She's also written for Elle and Mademoiselle, and she's been blogging from the shows all week. Go to our website, here-now.org, to take a look at what it is we're about to talk about. Gina, welcome.
Hello.
Well, and reading your blog, Busy Girl, I mean, you've seen dozens of fashion shows. So here's what we're going to do. I have a couple lists of trends here. Let's hear yours first. Just tick them off, what the trends are.
Lots of shine, so Lurex knits, paillettes.
Wait. I have no idea what you're saying.
Too much fashion speak for you?
Yeah, well, Lurex knit. What was that first one?
Lurex knits. So, you know, it's like something that's shiny. So if it's in a knit, it has like a, like the thread is gold, so it looks kind of shiny.
And what was the second thing you said?
Paillettes.
And that is what?
Those are round, shiny. They almost look like little fish scales.
You know, I have to tell you, while you're speaking, Gina, in the studio with me is Austin Mayfield, our fashionista intern. She's also a grad student at Boston University. She was supposed to be working this past week. Instead, she was online watching a lot of Fashion Week.
Right.
And she's been sort of sign language interpreting for me while you're speaking.
Is she making like a circle sign?
Yes, circle signs and, you know, threads through the sweater.
It's shiny.
Right.
Austin,
thanks, Austin.
I want to bring Austin into the conversation because, Austin, what did you see at Fashion Week this week?
I just saw a lot of vintage-y things. And tell me if I was wrong, but it looked like closet stuff, but better.
You know, designers always go to the past. So, you know, whether it was like the Betsy Johnson show, where she showed all these great printed dresses that looked like from the 1940s, or Jill Stewart, who went in the opposite direction in the 60s, it was very mod and kind of clean shapes.
Austin, when you say closet stuff, it's like stuff that, you know, your mom has in the back of the closet with a flower print on it, looks like a kitchen dress?
Right, and that I tell her, don't throw that out because I can wear it now.
Right.
Oh, yeah, you never know.
Give it
to
me.
Very cool. Do we understand, Gina, that Betsy Johnson and others were showing a lot of socks with those dresses?
Yeah, socks. Are, you know, fall is all about leg wear. So I know this past season girls were wearing a lot of leggings and black opaque tights, but that's over. There's lots of colorful tights, either plum or even like gray. Everything's kind of textured. So tights or socks are really big.
Wait a minute. You just said black tights were over. We're getting conflicting messages here.
Uh-oh.
Because one fashion writer was saying that it may only be over because there may be none left, that so many things were done with black tights at these shows. Is that not true?
To me, it wasn't new. We saw that last season.
Oh, okay. We only want new.
I only want new.
Okay. Well, tell us some more of the things that you saw, the trends.
I saw a lot of patent little booties, patent gloves, and I saw a lot of layering. So you have like a thin turtleneck under a printed dress, and thank goodness it's seasonless. All these dresses you can wear in the summer, and then you can layer it under a turtleneck with a cardigan with your tights for the winter.
Excellent. Well, we're online right now, are we not, Austin?
And yes.
We're looking at your blog, Gina, and I want to ask, I'm looking at a couple of pictures from the Berardi show?
Uh-huh.
And
yeah.
I want to know, what is the new black? Is gray the new black? Because they seem to be dressed entirely in shades of gray.
Yeah, gray is a prominent color. So is purple, and so is like a purpley ink blue. But I say gray is pretty big on the runway.
Is it a lighter gray, or is it a lot of the charcoal that we were seeing some last fall?
A little bit of both.
Oh,
but
Austin.
Probably more charcoal.
See, Austin paying attention. Well, another thing that Austin and I noticed, we have the Boston Globe in front of us, and they laid out some of their list. Here they say, the rules for fall 2007, grounded, practical, sturdy, cut from wools, demure, subversively sexy, bows at the neck.
Sure.
Are we doing that again?
Yeah, that's still here.
Too bad.
But that doesn't mean you have to wear it.
Okay. Peter Pan collars?
Sure, yeah. That goes into, there's still the baby doll trend happening. There's all those dresses that look like, you know, a five-year-old should wear them.
Well, they do. That's what we wanted to ask you about. They sort of look like big bell peppers that people would wear. What is that?
It's a big shapeless sack.
Yeah, and that's back.
Yes, shapeless sacks are back.
Well, we see the softening things, you know, the bows at the neck and the Peter Pan collars, but then we're also reading in the New York Times that some of the themes from the Zac Posen show were, as you said, the purple, but curved architectural lines. What does that mean to you?
Probably something that's very structured and shows the line of the body. Not something that we show a lot of at 17.
No, because, this is something Austin was curious about. Are young people, 17 readers, is this the kind of thing they'd actually wear?
No, I mean, a lot of what they show on the runway is quite theatrical. And it's my job to kind of take everything in and translate what I think our girl will wear, because she's going to school and she has a busy life and she doesn't want anything too fussy. So, I just have to translate it for her.
How would you translate some of the things you saw this week?
It's great for our reader. Like I said, there's lots of layers. So, a girl can kind of wear those short little minis with tights and socks and not kind of feel overexposed at school. Mm-hmm. So I just think there's lots of great trends for her.
Gina, I noticed that everywhere you shop now, you might be able to get a hold of a designer name, whether it's Isaac Mizrahi for Target or Target or Victor and Rolf at H&M. How much of the high fashion actually gets translated into those lines that pretty much everyone has access to?
Well, there's kind of two things going on. I think those stores always look to the runways to get their newest trend information, and they're just so quick to translate it. I mean, I can see something on the runway this week, and a few months from now, you'll see it in an H&M or a Forever 21. And then the other thing that's happening are stores, like you said, like Target and H&M are partnering with, really big designer names, so you can get that look for a lot less. So I love that that's going on.
Gina Kelly, again, fashion director for 17 Magazine. And we just want to ask you, you're obviously well aware of the headlines about models starving themselves to death to look thin. How do you address this issue? Some people say fashion magazines are a part of the problem.
Actually, 17 is one of the few magazines that shoots a lot of real girls, real teens. It's really important to us to send a message that, you don't have to be a size 2 or blonde to be accepted or be beautiful or be able to wear current fashions. I mean, that's America. Like, girls comes in different shapes and sizes. So that's what kind of we promote.
Just a couple last thoughts. You've given us purple, color, bag dresses, and dresses, period, a lot of dresses. But
yeah, still a big season for dresses.
Yep. What else?
I love all the swing coats, which, they're a little bit cropped. Some of the sleeves are 3/4, and I saw some really gorgeous ones from Philosophy and from Genera, all these plaid, really cute swing coats, very feminine.
Okay. Gina Kelly, fashion director of 17 Magazine. Poor thing, she's had to go to. How many shows have you gone to?
I've been probably to about 30 of them.
Oh, boy. Well,
yeah.
Then I'm sure you're sick of Justin Timberlake. Because
no, are you kidding?
You can't be sick of Justin.
All right, then.
You.
All right, then. Let's underscore the segment with the music that apparently brings every model down the runway, Justin Timberlake.
He's bringing sexy back.
Okay. All right. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
I'm bringing sexy back. The mother boys don't know how to act. I think it's special what's behind your back. So I'm turn around and I'll pick up the slack. Take up this bridge. Dirty babe.
Well, that's our take on fashion, or as our engineer Doug Sugart says, The View comes to public radio. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, Kevin Sullivan, Emiko Tamagawa, Alex Ashlock, Hitesh Hatti, and Virginia Prescott. Doug Sugart is our engineer, our web producer Ken George, interns Austin Mayfield, Emily Reddy, our managing editor Chris Ballman, the senior producer of Here and Now, Kathleen McKenna. I'm Robin Young. Have a great weekend. Join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next.